Perashat Teruma begins from the more difficult Perashiyot. For the next four or five Perashiyot, we're discussing the construction of the Mishkan. In English, we call the Mishkan a tabernacle. What was exactly the Mishkan, just so we get an understanding what it is, because we never saw one. We don't have one today. The closest thing today that we have to a Mishkan would be this room over here. A Bet Midrash, a yeshiva, a synagogue. What the Mishkan was, it was a portable sanctuary. What they would do is they would build it. It was made up of very expensive materials, priceless pieces, all gold, all silver, all the most precious stones. And it was a purpose in order to bring God down from heaven to rest on earth, so to speak. And I say so to speak, it was his house, his dwelling. And as a result of that, the Jewish people were elevated to a different level. The Pasuk writes, make for me a Mikdash, ve'asuli Mikdash, God directs them, make for me a Mikdash, ve'shachanti betocham, so I may dwell in them. So it seems that the purpose of the Mishkan was not that God should dwell in the Mishkan. It's somehow the Mishkan, with all its intent and different mysticism that was behind it, God was now able to rest in the heart of every single Jew. And the Mishkan lasted for the Jewish people 40 years in the desert. Whenever they traveled, they would disassemble it. They would carry it. We're going to learn today that most of the vessels in the Mishkan had poles in order to make it transportable. And then when they get to the next destination, they'd undo it, they'd build it again. And that's where God would communicate to Moshe. For example, any message that God wanted to tell Moshe, Moshe would go to the Mishkan. He'd go into the holy area and he'd hear God's voice come out. And then he'd go out and communicate the lesson to the people. So the Mishkan is a very, very important aspect of Jewish life in the Midbar. Eventually, when the Jews came into the land of Israel, Shlomo HaMelech built a permanent Mishkan. The permanent Mishkan we call the Beit HaMikdash. The first Beit HaMikdash lasted for 410 years. And that was probably the most glorious years in Jewish history, when the Jews were living in Israel, self-governed. There was fear amongst the world to the Jewish people, and the Goyim honored the holy temple that the Jewish people built under the leadership of Shlomo HaMelech. Again, a lot of this stuff we're saying over here is right over our heads, because we have no idea what is the Beit HaMikdash, what's its function, what do we gain by it, what do we need it for. We're so far removed that one rabbi once said that while during the 3 weeks in the summer of Tisha B'Av, those sad weeks, that we're supposed to be a little more morbid, a little more serious, mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So one rabbi said it the best. He said, we have to mourn not the Beit HaMikdash, but we have to mourn the fact that we have no idea why we're mourning. That's already it's a lower level. At least there were certain generations that understood the value of a Beit HaMikdash and what does it mean for the Jewish people. So they cried for the loss. For us, unfortunately, we're so far removed, so you cry, but you have no idea what you're crying for. You cry because everybody's crying, and that's what you're supposed to do, but it's a big deal. So you have no Beit HaMikdash, but we have a beautiful house. And so we have cars, we have, we have vacations, which I'm the same way. It's hard to appreciate a situation in Jewish life. We have to trust the Hachamim when they tell us it was a loss. So we're crying for the fact that we don't know why we're crying. To build the Mishkan, it obviously cost a lot of money. And the first appeal, and the first drive for funds in Jewish history was collecting for the Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu had to solicit all the Jewish people to make donations. And it was the most successful appeal in history, where we're going to learn in the later parashiyot, Moshe has to tell the people enough. That's it. The register's full. We collected enough money. Tell the people, stop bringing. Now that never happened, and that's never going to happen. They say we collected enough money. Even if they collected enough money, they'll never let us know that they collected. The honesty of Moshe was, we have enough, keep your money. We said we could do without it. That's the lesson. So one rabbi said a nice point. He said, in the beginning of the parasha, we learn about the donations that the Jewish people made. The gold, the silver, etc. So he said, in last week's parasha, if you remember, we learned about all the laws of business. Honesty in business, not charging interest, paying your workers on time, not fabricating, not lying, not cheating a customer, and so on and so forth. A full parasha on civil law. On laws, how to be a decent person, man to man. So he said brilliantly, he said, and that's why the laws of charity are written right after that, to teach you that it's a privilege to give charity, and the money that you give for charity, it must be clean money. And unfortunately, many people justify their less than honest business practice by the fact that they give a lot of money. And look at all the charity we give, and look at all the support we give. And therefore, that takes the edge off, at least in their minds, that, you know, so there is a justification for our shady business practices, because look, the yeshiva is benefiting, look, the achamim are benefiting, look, the synagogue is benefiting. If I didn't give them all this money, how would they be able to extend and build? So the Torah is coming to connect last week's civil law with this week's charity collection, to teach you that the money that you collect for Torah institutions must be clean, tahor, pure money. We have a concept in our religion called mitzvah haba'a ba'avera, which means it's possible sometimes to do a mitzvah while simultaneously committing a sin. And in that case, the Torah says, better don't do the mitzvah. Don't do a mitzvah that the only way to do it in your mind is by committing a sin. The classical case is, somebody, the Gemara discusses it, somebody on Sukkot went and he stole his friend's lulav. So now he's going in front of God and shaking a lulav and making all the berachot and everything on stolen goods. So Borei Olam says, don't shake the lulav. Don't shake the, better you didn't shake the lulav, better you didn't come to synagogue, better you didn't get involved in this, but to make sins in order to serve God. And the truth of the matter is, we can apply this to many cases of, we have to make sure that our mitzvah performance, even when it comes to many times in the synagogue, in the afternoons, on Shabbat, the synagogue's crowded. Everybody's excited to come and study and learn Torah, and that's the most noble thing that's going on in the community. When people are excited to study Torah, it's a mitzvah. But how many times do I hear stories from people that unfortunately that are embarrassed or being humiliated by other people? A lady comes to sit in the shiur. She doesn't know. She doesn't know anything. She's trying to learn. She came to a class. Is there anything more noble than that? The mere fact that the lady came to a class, that's it. It's, you don't say anything. That's the greatest success. And she deserves not to be chastised on anything she's doing, because eventually the Torah will, she'll understand, and it'll work automatically. But many overzealous people that are sitting in class and they see their neighbor, oh, what are you doing this for? And what are you doing that for? And they become disenchanted, and they become embarrassed, and they feel as if they're being looked upon from above instead of looked at, and they don't want to come back. They feel as if maybe we're not religious enough, maybe we can't sit here, maybe we're doing... This is not an avera to disenchant and to uninspire and to demotivate somebody to come and study Torah because of a comment. And trust me, that person that's making that comment thinks she's saving the world. Look, I'm fighting God's battles over here. Why are you ripping the paper? How come you're not, your sleeve is 2 inches short? It's not your business. It's not your business to cause embarrassment and harm and shame to somebody that came to study a Torah. So you walk outside, I did a mitzvah. But how'd you do the mitzvah? Our Torah says very clearly, when you rebuke somebody, in my opinion, you shouldn't rebuke somebody, because today we don't know how to give a rebuke. But if you rebuke somebody, if you're an exception, if you're that 1 out of 1,000 people that learned how to give rebuke, and if you are, after the class, stay and you'll teach me how to give rebuke, because I don't know how to give rebuke, because it's such a sensitive thing. People are sensitive today. You have to be so careful how to phrase it, how to say it. You have to be so l'shem shamayim. You have to be... it can't be anything personal. It has to be totally altruistic and idealist. Not so easy to give rebuke. And therefore, we're not preachers. None of us should be preachers. But in that case, where a person is forced to give a rebuke because there's no choice, it has to be done in private. It has to be done after 5 minutes of telling the person how much admiration you have for them, and how much you love them, and how much you appreciate them. And only after that, you can give a timid, light rebuke so that people understand. One rabbi used to say, when a barber shaves the back of a person's neck, when he's taking a haircut, before he cuts, what does he do? He puts shaving cream, he lathers first. Before you cut somebody, before you give them a rebuke, first you have to lather them, first you have to put the shaving cream. And after that, then you want to give it, but to make it smooth. So therefore, the Torah is telling you over here, a lesson not only in charity, just like your charity has to be clean from sin, all your Torah observance must be clean from sin. Just because you're doing a mitzvah does not now give you a license to do whatever you want, to become wild now, to become out of the box and do things that are not warranted. On the contrary, a mitzvot must be mitzvot without any byproduct of avera. The Torah then tells us about some of the donations that were given. Actually, the Torah lists about 15 different things that were given. And the last of the things that the Torah mentions that were given were Abnei Shoham. Abnei Shoham and Abnei Miluim. Now, we don't know too much about these stones today. The Shoham stones. These stones over here, it's an understatement to call them precious stones. They were one of a kind, and they found themselves in the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. It's a priceless piece. So the rabbis ask, where did these stones come from? Hachamim tell us through the Torah that it was the presidents of the tribe. Each tribe had a president. That was their donation. They came to Moshe and said, we'll take care of these stones. Now that's a tremendous amount of generosity and goodness of heart to donate such an item. So the rabbis ask, why did they put it last in the list then? This should have been, you're listing all the donations when we make a paper for all the dedications of the shul. Usually we put the name of the building first, $2 million. And you put the water fountain, you put it towards the end. Over here, however, the Torah lists the gold, silver, all those things are nice. And then you put the major item, the most expensive piece in the donation, you put it towards the end. It's like a little maybe disrespectful. Imagine a person gave a $2 million donation to the shul, and you get the dedication list, and you see the guy that donated the mezuzah, he's on top of you. So you say, yeah, you're offended. Why put them last? So the Or HaChaim HaKadosh teaches us a great lesson. He says like this, a fact. The stones came to the presidents of the tribes miraculously. Something to the sort of the clouds that were protecting the Jewish people when they were walking through the desert. One morning, the clouds deposited these stones in front of their homes. Now, of course, they had a right to keep it as their own. But they were generous and they gave it to the Beit HaMikdash. But says the Or HaKadosh, while the amount of the donation was big, but the effort into the donation was minimal. And in giving money to charity, one of the most important things that God looks at is the effort that is put behind it. When a person earns his money, and a person works for his money, and his sweat is in the money, and his toil is in the money, and his time is in the money, and his blood is in the money sometimes. So for him to give that money to a holy thing, it's not the amount anymore. It's the fact that he's giving up a piece of his life to the Kodesh. So God looks at the heart behind the donation. He looks at the effort that was taken to give that donation. Now, we're not minimizing the fact that the presidents gave these stones, but it came to them easy. It was windfall profit. It was something that fell in front of their house. They didn't have to work for it. They didn't have to toil for it. They just had to pick it up from their front step and deliver it to the Beit HaMikdash. Nice!
We give them credit. But you can't compare that to somebody that worked and toiled and effort and went and came. So therefore the Torah lists it in the order, not of value, but in the order of heart. And therefore it might be said that while in the laws of charity it's proper to give 10%. It's proper. Without getting into the laws. I'm not saying it's mandatory either. I'm being careful. It's proper. It's nice. But that being said, who is it easier for to give 10%? A wealthy man or a poor man? Well, a wealthy man that gives 10%, again, it's noble. But he's left with wealth. A poor man, he's probably not even obligated to give 10% in truth. That's why a poor man is a bad example. Not a middle class man. Somebody that has money, but so it's a little more difficult to give the 10% because he's giving now, by giving the 10%, he's sacrificing more things. The rich man can give the 10% and not change his lifestyle a bit. He can do everything he wants to do. But the middle guy, he might give the 10%, but now he can't go out to eat every week, or he can't travel two times a year. He has to cut something. So God looks at that effort, but bottom line, percentage-wise, you gave 10, you gave 10. It's not equal. The effort and the heart and the sacrifice that comes out behind the giving can put two givers. One guy gave $10 and one guy gave $1,000, but sometimes the 10 is able to be much higher. That's important. Now, I'd like to say one more point regarding a charity. Although on Shabbat we're going to talk about charity at length, I'd like to make one point that we're not going to make on Shabbat. The Torah writes, "Daberel b'nei Yisrael v'yikhu li teruma." God says, when you give the donation, give it for me. Rashi writes on that word, li, for me. He writes the word lishmi. Give it for the sake of God. What does he mean by that? Give it for the sake of God. God bless our community. There's no community in the world that gives charity like our community. This is a fact. This is clear. The amount of functions and the amount of money that's poured into charitable organizations in the course of a year is a testimony to the philanthropic ideology that our people have. We learned this from our parents, from our grandparents. We were taught this from the great leaders of the community. And God bless the ingenuity of people to figure out ways to collect money, because you have to figure out, you have to have a sales pitch. So they came up years ago with the concept of a Chinese auction, which again, I'm all for. It's a great, if it raises money for a good institution, it's a great thing. You're not stealing any money, you're not robbing anything, it's honest business. But it doesn't serve the contributors so good. And I'll tell you why. It serves the institution great. But the contributors are not served well by a Chinese auction always, unless you hear what I'm going to tell you. Because a lot of times now we're giving charity, but it's not the pure motivation anymore. And I'm not saying it's wrong. It's right to give you for the wrong motivation, because what is the yeshiva care? What does Bikur Halim care if you were properly motivated or not? Bottom line, we got you 100 bucks, we can feed poor people. So you got a problem with your motivation. But bottom line, you help people. So I'm not telling you to stop. I'm just telling you that we have to be more purely motivated. And how are you going to know if you're purely motivated? You'll know that if you didn't win, the next morning, how do you feel? Good. You feel good. Then you're purely motivated. So therefore, you know, if a guy doesn't win, he says, I spent all that money. I didn't win any. I never win. The attitude must be, your charity is a victory. The charity itself is a victory if you never won. And therefore, because you gave the tzedakah what? For a piece of jewelry? That's what motivated you? That's what got you to take the money out of your pocket? The institution should have given, the institution warranted that. So we're on a lower level. We need to be, you know, like a child. You have to give them ice cream to come to shul. So you have to show a necklace so they give charity. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's not the most purely motivated mitzvah of tzedakah. And that's why I advise my own family, my wife, whenever we go to these events, at least some of the coupons that you're filling out to show your idealism to the charity, put somebody else's name on it. That already will show you it's not for you. That's it. Put somebody else's name on it. Put my friend, somebody that's needy. Somebody, so at least you're sorry, not for me. I'm doing. So now you're doing another chesed. At least it shows I didn't come here to win. I didn't come here to make a killing over here on an auction over here to come out with booty and things like that. The charity turns into a, it can bring out the worst in people, unfortunately, and therefore it needs to be. It needs to be a little adjusted. I'm not saying not to go, but it needs to be adjusted, the intent at the time that you're giving the charity. That's what Hashem means when he says, Li Lishmi. God says, remember when you give charity, have me in mind. Do it for the right reasons. Now the Torah continues, and the Torah talks about the Aron, probably the most important vessel in the whole entire Mishkan was the Aron. What was the Aron? In English they call it the Ark. I'm not going to belittle this class by comparing the Ark, but just so you have a feeling what it was, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, that was that Ark, that's what they're talking about. That's the Ark that used to be in the Beit HaMikdash, that used to be in the Mishkan. You'll forgive my example, I just want to so you understand it. What was in this ark that made it so important? So it says the tablets. The original tablets that Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai, they were placed in the Aron. But our rabbis tell us something else. It wasn't the only thing in the Aron. They put a Sefer Torah in the Aron also. The Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote. But there was a third thing, and this is probably the most important thing. If you remember, there were two sets of tablets. The first set, Moshe Rabbeinu threw down the mountain and shattered into pieces. Those pieces of the shattered Luchot were also placed in the Aron. So the Gemara asks the obvious question, what's the purpose? You want to save them because they're a collector's item, you know, the nostalgia, so put them in Ginizah. But to put them in the Aron. So the rabbis learn a lesson from me. From here we learn that a rabbi, that because of old age, or because of, God forbid, sickness, or because of any other reasons, loses his wisdom and starts to regress and starts to become, God forbid, senile and starts to forget his learning, you still must afford him the same respect that you gave him while he had his Torah. And the proof is, these luchot that were shattered, they're not holy anymore. It's finished. You can't read them, you can't use them, there's no Torah, there's no lessons you can learn from it. But God said, since once they were the item, since once they had the Ten Commandments on them, even though now they don't have it anymore, but you must respect them for not what they are, but for what they were. And therefore we have to put them in the Aron, next to the... And that's a lesson. A lot of times we see the old Chachamim as they age. So we become less motivated to respect them. They're not as sharp as they used to be. They're not as smart as they used to be. They're weakened. And therefore we think that, you know, our respect is measured by the wisdom of the Chacham. It's not so. The respect of the Chacham must be under all situations. Alav HaShalom, our former chief rabbi, Chaim Yaakov Katzin, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha. Chaim Yaakov was from the greatest Chachamim that ever set foot in America. There's no question about it. He was a master of not only the Peshat, but he was a master of the Kabbalah. He owned it. There was nobody that read Kabbalah and Zohar until today. It's hard to find a close second to Chacham Yaakov's ability and to his talent and to his genius, to his humility, to his nature, to everything. But towards the end of his life, it's clear that the Chacham, because of old age or whatever reason it was, there was a regression. Of course, it's sad to see. Sad to see a man that was so advanced in wisdom to regress, but that's the nature of old age sometimes. But does that mean that the Chacham does not deserve the same respect as he had when he was on top of the world? It means no. That's Shifrei Luchot. That's a broken Luchot. And the broken Luchot are placed right next to the keepers, right next to the regular. There's another lesson learned from the Aron. Look at the measurements of this piece. The measurements are 2.5 amot length, 1.5 amah wide, and 1.5 tall. The point that I want to make is all the measurements of the Aron are half measurements. 2.5, 1.5, 1.5. It's the only vessel in the whole Mishkan that all its dimensions are half measurements. And the question is why. And here's an important lesson. Again, the Aron represents Torah scholarship. Our rabbis always make comparisons between the rabbis and the Aron. Because what's the Aron? It houses the Torah. What is a scholar supposed to be? Somebody that houses the Torah. But the Torah is coming to tell you, Torah is not like any other wisdom. It cannot be acquired in an arrogant person. Arrogance is a repellent to Torah greatness. God despises arrogance and will not allow His wisdom to succeed in an arrogant vessel. The Gemara tells a famous story of a rabbi called Rabbi Yehoshua. I wouldn't say it if the Gemara didn't say it, but the Gemara says that Rabbi Yehoshua was, he was uncomely. He wasn't a handsome man. Let's put it in a nice way. So he once went to the Caesar. He was connected to the king. And the princess, the king's daughter, the Caesar's daughter, said, Hakam, Chochmah mefu'ara, such glorious wisdom, Bichli mechu'ar, in such an ugly receptacle. They were very, very upfront. They told it like it was. They didn't have any inhibitions in those days. So the rabbi didn't get moved. He didn't take it personal. So he answered. He said, let me ask you a question. Your father, he has wine? Of course, my father has the best wine. Where does he store the wine in? So she doesn't know. She went to the vat. She went to the cellar. And she sees that the wine is stored in wooden barrels. So the rabbi says, such beautiful, delicious wine. You store it in wooden barrels? You're the king's daughter. You should put it in gold. So he said, wow, I never thought about that. You're right. What are we doing over here? We have money. So she told the king's butlers, change all the barrels to gold. 2 days later, the king asks for a cup of wine. He gets it. It's vinegar. Bring me another cup. Vinegar. What is going on over here? So they said, your daughter said to change all the barrels to gold. So he says, that's true? She said, I didn't say anything. The rabbi told me. Of course, it was the rabbi's fault. So they went now. She calls the rabbi back. The king calls the rabbi back. What are you doing? What are you telling my daughters? I didn't say anything. I just answered her question. What are you talking? She asked me, how come such glorious wisdom in an ugly vessel? So I said, look at your father's wine. Sometimes the greatest things to retain their greatness must be placed in humble surroundings. Torah is one of them. So he was saying, the reason why I have such glorious wisdom is maybe because I don't have the best look, so it keeps me humble. Because I have a built-in safety feature not to become arrogant, so maybe that's why my wisdom is so great. The rabbi was trying to teach the girl that humility is the key component for success in Torah. And that's why the measurements of the Aron are all half measurements. In order to teach the scholar, you're a half measurement. You're not complete. You're lacking. You have deficiencies. You're not. It's not 2 feet by 1 foot by 1 foot. Those are complete measurements. It's 2.5. You still have more to go. You still have more to learn. It's 1.5. And that's why we refer to rabbis as chachamim. But if you look in the Gemara calls rabbis talmidei chachamim. Now those are two contradictory terms. Talmid means a student. Chacham means a scholar. So it's either you're a Talmid or you're a Chacham. How could you be at the same time a Talmid Chacham? And the answer is, since when a scholar has a humility that he understands that he doesn't know anything, and he has an attitude that he still has a lot to learn, and he understands that he's incomplete like a student that understands that he still needs to acquire knowledge and still advance himself. If a person has an attitude of a Talmid, then he can be called a Chacham. And hence the name Talmid Chacham. That's why our Torah is compared to water. Always whenever the rabbis give examples to Torah, they compare the Torah to water. Why? So the simple explanation is because water is life-sustaining. You can't live without water. Everybody needs water. The Torah is water. You need water. Everybody has to have some sort of water. But based on what we're saying today, there's a different explanation. Water always seeks its level. Water always goes from a high place and trickles down to a low place. And if there's a lower place, the water will find it. Water always seeks to the bottom, to the lowest place. And that's Torah also. Torah, wisdom, will trickle down into the minds of humble people. It'll always find the low person. And that's why when one of the former Surgeon Generals of the United States, Dr. Koop, that was a big, big doctor, Surgeon General of the United States of America, a big man. He once visited Rabbi Feinstein, alav shalom, in his East Side apartment in Manhattan. Rabbi Feinstein was analyzing an unfortunate case that took place. It was a case of Siamese twins. God forbid, we should know from these cases. But there's a question of separating them and halakhically and how and what. So he needed to understand what exactly is going on over here. Before he can make a ruling, he has to understand the facts. So who better to explain to Rabbi Feinstein the facts than the best doctor in the country? So they got him to come to the rabbi's apartment. And they're back and forth. This and that. And the rabbi's just sitting in a half hour with the rabbi. And Koop walks out and he tells his aides, all my life I've been on college campuses throughout America. I've spoken to the greatest professionals and the greatest doctors and the greatest teachers and professors in university. And in my life, I never met a man that has such godly, saintly wisdom coupled with a humility unparalleled. This is what impressed Koop. Usually when you see scholars, with scholarship comes arrogance. They have deal. Just so you get a feeling, and this is not a knock to doctors, but many times when you go to a doctor, you feel very low, you feel very small when you talk to a doctor. Why do you feel small? Because he has such wisdom, and he makes it simple, and if you don't understand it, he gets nervous, and he has to repeat it, and he expects you to know everything. So you walk out, you feel like a nothing. So you understand he has great wisdom, but there's a little arrogance over there. So Rabbi Feinstein was able to possess tremendous chokhmah, but at the same time, you didn't feel he was on top of you. On the contrary, because I never saw such a thing. To have such a level of scholarship, but to maintain a level of humility, and that's exactly what the Torah is telling you. The Aron must be half measurements. Now I understand this class should what are we giving these class to ladies for? Give the class to rabbis. But it's important for us to know exactly how Judaism is supposed to look. You know, so the next time you come along and say, well, these rabbis, you're never supposed to learn Judaism from Jews. Jews are the worst example of what Judaism is, unfortunately. Judaism is supposed to be learned from this book over here. If somebody would follow this entire book, then already you'd say, wow, what a piece, what a product, it's unbelievable. Unfortunately, A lot of Jews, some guys follow the beginning of the book, some guys follow the middle, some guys follow the end. So we always have claims against Judaism. What's going on over here? Why can they do this? How can they do that? It's no reflection on the book. The book is perfect. So you just have to find somebody that's doing it all, and then you'll be impressed, and you'll be sold, and you'll want in. That's why I'm teaching you today a little of what Judaism is supposed to look like. So when you see it done the wrong way, so no, but the rabbi said that humility is important in the Torah's eyes. Hakam has to feel not to dominate over people and not to look. So I want you to know what the pure way is. So you have no claims. It's a disclaimer in order to protect our religion. The Aron was plated. It was plated with gold. And then on the side of it, there were two rings. And in those rings, there was Badim. Badim are two poles. And the poles were used, obviously, to transport the Aron. They would run across the sides, two poles running across the sides. And when they had to move, they would lift the poles and they'd carry it. But the interesting thing is, the Torah says you're not allowed ever to remove the poles. The poles always must stay in the rings. Now that's a little strange. If the whole purpose of the poles is to transport, so now you're here, so you should take the poles out, put them in storage, and when you need to come out, put the poles back. Why to leave the poles steady and permanent into the rings? Hakamim explained to us that while the Aron itself represents Torah and rabbis and wisdom, you know what the poles represent? The supporters of Torah. The benefactors of Torah. Those people that donate generously, that without their support, there would be no learning. If there wouldn't be good people with great hearts that understood the value of the learning of Torah and they did not support it, I would be able to study. There would be no Torah in the world. Hence, the Torah is telling you a great lesson. The supporters of Torah are equal to the learners of Torah. And therefore, there's a bond between them that cannot be removed. When finally the Aron lands in its place, you don't take the supporters, okay, we'll see you later, put you in the garage until we need you again. On the contrary, those that support Torah, like the poles, they remain part and parcel with the Aron itself. They're never removed. But then the Hafez Chaim took it a step further. He said, their level even is in eternity. That where the Chacham sits in eternity, that's where the supporter sits. It's the same block, it's the same level. So the Hafez Chaim asks the question. He said, that could be quite embarrassing. Because the scholar on his level is going to be sitting with other scholars. And in Olam Abba, they're going to be talking Torah, whatever they're going to, religion. And the businessman that's supported, well, he's a good guy, but he's not fluent. How's he going to be part of the conversation? Joe, what do you have to say? Well, I don't know what you're talking about. But I'm happy to be here. So the Hafez Chaim says that when the rabbis tell us that they're going to be in the same spot with the Hachamim, it means, and they're going to have understanding like the Hachamim. They're going to have the ability to discuss. They're going to have the ability of having the wisdom. And therefore the poles must stay because there is an equality between both of them. Not only in honor and respect, but in level. A famous story told about Rav Chaim Volozhin, the Rosh Yeshiva Volozhin Yeshiva, that he was once discussing in the yeshiva a complicated subject of Shatnez, the laws of wool and linen. They were back and forth debating it, and the rabbi was confused. He couldn't figure out the case. That night he had a dream. And a wealthy man from heaven, used to be a benefactor in the yeshiva, came to Rav Chaim Volozhin and said, well, the case is like this, and the answer is like this, and this is the way you solve it. Rav Chaim said, in all due respect, how do you know it is? You weren't too smart in life. He said, but Rabbi, the investment that I made in supporting the yeshiva, you don't know where they put me. They put me in Shamayim. All of a sudden I became Gaon, I'm Agam. I know everything. I don't wanna... So Rav Chaim learned from there the lesson of the Badim, that the supporters of Torah can sleep good at night knowing that they're connected and they are part and parcel with these great levels. These are just a few, one more story, if you'll allow me, ladies. Next week I'm not going to be here. Next week I'm away. So I'll give you one more story for, this will count for next week's class. We learned about the table. The Torah tells us the Shulchan, one of the vessels in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, was a table. And the table had on it 12 loaves of bread. And the 12 loaves of bread, there was a miracle. They used to put it on Shabbat, and then they'd leave it for a week, and then the next Shabbat they take off the old bread and put on new bread. And the Torah tells us there was a miracle that the bread remained piping hot the whole week. And without any preservatives, the bread remained fresh. That's a miracle of miracles. There wasn't a hot plate, it wasn't a microwave, it was just a regular table with bread. So the story is told of one of the Jews that escaped Spain. He lived in Portugal, actually. And in the times of the persecutions, the Inquisition, Jews were forced to leave and run away. So one of these Sephardic Jews found himself in Israel somewhere, in Sefat, actually, in the same town as the great sage, the Arizal, the great Kabbalist. And this was a very simple man. He went to a class one day and he heard the rabbi talking in this week's parasha about the table and about the bread and how beautiful and the miracles. And the rabbi was saying, oh, what a shame. Today we don't have a way to put bread on God's table, and it's such a terrible thing. And the guy was a simple guy. He got moved. He said, yeah, it's a terrible shame. God doesn't have a table with bread on it after such benefits that... So he had an idea. He went home to his wife, and he told his wife, listen, every Friday I want you to make halot. I'm going to buy you the best flour. I'm going to buy you the best everything, the best ingredients. I want you to make me 12 loaves of bread, just like they had on the table of God, and I'll handle it. Every Shabbat, he used to take the 12 loaves of bread, go to the synagogue, open the ark, and put 12 breads next to the Sefer Torah. He told God, Hashem, please, I know you don't have the Shulchan anymore of the Beit HaMikdash, of the Mishkan, but please let these 12 breads, let them, you know, be accepted. And he calls it. He'd come to Shul Saturday morning, they'd open the Sefer Torah, he looked, the bread's gone. He said, Shibi Jannin, Borei Olam's taking it, they're eating it, he's doing, he was excited, he said, I don't believe it. So he's doing this for a long time. Now what was happening? The Shamosh of the Shul, every Friday, he cleans up, so he opens up the Sefer Torah, he sees 12, he says, what's going on? I was putting, but he looked, they were delicious, they smelled good, they're fresh. So he said, who could be putting this, with pranksters doing this over here? So he took them, he went every Friday night, the Shamosh went, he ate all the bread, his family, he's doing this for a year or two, whatever it was. And he thinks he's doing the greatest thing in the world. So now, the rabbi of the synagogue, one day was in the synagogue preparing his class, and this guy walks in with his bags of bread, and the rabbi's looking for him. What's this guy doing? He sees him opening the thing, setting him up, closing it, making a prayer to God. So he tells the guy, listen, buddy, come here. What are you doing? What's going on over here? He says, well, rabbi, you know, I was in a class, and they talked about the bread, and I thought, you know, I want to give them to God. And you don't believe it, rabbi? Every week I come back, they're not there. So the rabbi was a little tough. Rabbi said, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? You're talking gibberish. You're putting bread in the thing. I bet you the Shamosh is eating your bread. And the guy was devastated. Shamosh eating my bread. What are you talking about? Sure enough, the Shamosh walks in. And rabbi tells him, what's going on with that bread over there? Oh, yeah, I eat it every week. It's delicious. The best bread. And he says, wow, haram. He says, you misunderstood the rabbi. You didn't understand. Finished. After that event happened, the guy, of course, goes home. He's destroyed. He's destroyed. The Arizal, the great rabbi, summons this man, this rabbi, to his house. And he tells the rabbi, you made a big avon. Arizal knew this in Ruach HaKodesh. He said, you don't know what this meant to God, those loaves of bread. The intent that this man had, you can't imagine the pleasure. Even though the Shamosh was eating it, God doesn't eat bread. Somebody has to eat the bread. But the pleasure that God was getting with such a pure intent and such a L'shem Shamayim, and now you broke this guy, and now you deprived God from that Hana'ah. He told them, you're not going to make it to your next Derashah. And unfortunately, the next day, before the rabbi gave his Derashah, he passed on. That's a bad part of the story. That's a sad part of the story. But the lesson here is that Borei Olam also is looking for pureness of heart. He's looking, sometimes we don't know exactly how to do it. One rabbi told a student that wasn't the smartest kid. He says he doesn't know how to pray. He just knows Aleph Bet. He doesn't know anything. He just knows the Aleph Bet. So the rabbi just read the Aleph Bet all day long. Aleph Bet, Gimah. He's reading Aleph Bet, Gimah. So another rabbi walked in and said, what are you doing? I'm reading the Aleph Bet. What are you, crazy with the Aleph Bet? What kind of crazy? Don't do this. Who taught you to do this? That's what I know how to do. He said, don't do anything. Go to work. What are you wasting your time? So they came to that other rabbi and said, you don't understand the pureness of heart that this man had. God took all the letters and he rearranged them to the most beautiful blessings, to the most beautiful berachot. So therefore, this man's reading of Aleph Bet, although it looks childish, but since he was doing it, he didn't know about it. He's doing it because he thinks it's the right way. God finishes the job for him. And that's a lesson that we have to learn, that sometimes, even though the action might not be the smartest of actions, but we're going to be judged from the lev, from how much intent that we have, and God will finish the business for us. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen, amen.